Hello, everyone, and welcome to Cellular Healing TV. I'm your host, Meredith Dykstra, and this is episode number 148. Today, we have our resident healing specialist, Dr. Dan Pompa, of course. And today, we welcome back Professor Thomas Seyfried. He has been on the show before. It was about a year ago exactly, I checked the date, that we had him first on Cellular Healing TV. And we got so much of an amazing response, and it was quite an episode where we really delved really deeply into his research and the science that he's working on. So we decided, we asked him back and he agreed. So here we are a year later to talk more with Professor Seyfried. So excited to have you on the show. Before we get started, and in case you guys missed the first episode, which was part one, which was episode 94. So check that out for sure. I'm gonna tell you guys a little bit about Professor Seyfried and then we will jump right in. So Thomas N. Seyfried is professor of biology at Boston College and received his PhD in genetics and biochemistry from the University of Illinois Urbana in 1976. He did his undergraduate work at the University of New England, where he recently received the Distinguished Alumni Achievement Award. He also holds a master's degree in genetics from Illinois State University in Normal, Illinois. And Thomas Seyfried served with distinction in the United States Army's 1st Cavalry Division during the Vietnam War and received numerous medals and commendations. He was a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of Neurology at the Yale University School of Medicine and then served on the faculty as an assistant professor in neurology. Other awards and honors have come from such diverse organizations as the American Oil Chemist Society, the Ketogenic Diet Special Interest Group of the American Epilepsy Society. And Dr. Seyfried previously served as chair scientific advisory committee for the National Tay-Sachs and Allied Diseases Association and recently received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Academy of Complementary and Integrative Medicine. He presently serves on several editorial boards, including those for Nutrition and Metabolism, Neurochemical Research, and the Journal of Lipid Research and ASN Neuro. Dr. Seyfried has over 170 peer-reviewed publications and is author of the book Cancer as a Metabolic Disease on the Origin, Management, and Prevention of Cancer. His full list of peer-reviewed publications can be found on PubMed. So quite an impressive resume. Professor Seyfried, welcome back to Cellular Healing TV.
Well, thank you very much, Meredith. It's nice to be back.
Yeah. Hey. I don't know if I should, or if I should bow down. I think I'm just going to bow down because what an amazing guy. I'm going to embarrass you, right? I'm going to embarrass you. But that's quite the resume. I mean, last time you read it, I think I was impressed. This time, I'm even more impressed somehow. But here's the book. I'm just going to put it right up front because this book changed my life. It really did. And not that I had cancer, thank God. But it changed a lot of my teaching. And I'm honored and blessed to teach a lot of doctors around the country that now know your work. You know, I remember we were sitting around a small group at the cancer conference in Florida. There was eight of us. And I don't even remember you saying this, but we were talking about Mercola. And of course, Joe Mercola was in that small group of this little mastermind group. And you said, yeah, you know, if it wasn't for Joe's show, you said, I might have sold a few hundred books. But after Joe's show, I think you said you sold like 4,000 books, right?
So. Well, it was more than general, more than usual. Let's put it that way. Mainly because the book is not, unfortunately, the publishers charge quite a bit of money for this book. I told them I wish they could sell it for less, but they make it as a textbook, and that backs the price up significantly.
Well, I mean, this book, it is a textbook. I mean, this book has just, you know, years of your study and, you know, so much research. And I don't know a more research-backed book. And, you know, you had to. Otherwise, they'd be down your back, perhaps, because everything here that you said is, you know, you did an amazing job citing a lot of this research. And I even dug into that. But anyway, so up the top of the show, I just thank you so much for this book
that
changed not just my life, but, you know, the doctors and obviously so many of their patients and clients because of this book. Your work is amazing and immense, and hopefully we'll talk about some of the new things that you're doing. But here's the question I have right at the top, right? People are going to watch this show that either know somebody with cancer, has cancer, and I promise you, if you don't, this show is even more about not just cancer but cellular healing, because what works for cancer will make every cell healthier. But can we, here's the question, can we manage cancer today without the toxicity, meaning the chemo, the radiation, the immunotherapies, all of which we're doing with cancer? Can we manage cancer without the toxicity, positive out good cells? Because all of that might work for cancer, but it sure is making people sick. Is it possible, Tom?
Yeah, I think it is, and I'll talk about that. But you know, I should mention at the beginning, I think in at some point in the future, the field and the society will come to know that this period of cancer treatment will be recognized as the greatest fiasco in the history of medicine. What we are doing to people today to treat to make them healthy is absolutely incredible. It speaks to a fundamental lack of knowledge regarding the biology of the disease. There is no other disease that I know of where you have to poison and irradiate people to make them healthy. It's just beyond my comprehension. And the history of the disease has been this: surgically mutilate people, irradiate and burn them, and poison them to within an inch of their life, with the design ultimately of trying to cure them from a biological disease that in my mind can be managed better without this incredible toxicity. The question is, how do you do that? Well, first you have to recognize the very fundamental issue that cancer is a mitochondrial metabolic disease. It is not a genetic disease. Now, this is a very difficult concept for people to understand. Why? Because the therapies that we are using to treat the disease are based on the gene theory, which says that the genes are responsible for the dysregulated cell growth. And therefore, we must use any treatment we can to stop these proliferating cells, which is usually some toxic drug or a radiation or just, you know, surgically remove organs and things like this. The issue, of course, is, in my view, it's a mitochondrial metabolic disease. And as such, what you have to simply ask, what are these cells using as a fuel to maintain their state of proliferation?
Yeah, and let me just pull in, I mean, hold that thought for 1 minute. I want to peel, we have so many doctors that watch this show, and we have obviously the layperson looking for answers. Mitochondria is where our cells produce energy, and the cells can use fat as an energy source. Your theory has been that cancer cells, this is the problem, this is disrupted. There, just as an explanation of, you know, this is where the problem is, the mitochondria, the powerhouse of the cell where energy is produced, this is what's broken.
Yes. And the issue, of course, is that if you look at the data from a broad range of cancers, whether it's breast, colon, brain, bladder, you name it, they all have defects in the structure, function, and numbers of mitochondria in that diseased tissue. How people can say the mitochondria are not damaged in cancer is beyond my comprehension. The evidence is overwhelming. When you look at the electron microscopes, when you look at biochemical information, you can see in the tissues themselves the mitochondria damaged. If you're looking at tissue with damaged, few mitochondria, structurally abnormal, those cells cannot respire effectively. They cannot get energy from the typical way we get energy, which is breathing in air and using fuels to respire. So if you can't respire and breathe to get energy, the way those cells stay alive is they ferment. It's a very ancient process of energy metabolism. It existed in all cells on the planet before oxygen came into the environment. So those ancient pathways exist in all of our cells, but they play a very minor role under normal conditions, but a major role in cancer to keep those cells alive. They're not respiring, they're fermenting. So right. if they are fermenting, the question then becomes, what are they fermenting to generate the energy to sustain rapid proliferation? And the answer is glucose and glutamine. The evidence to support that is overwhelming in the literature. in the scientific literature. Top papers in the top scientific journals have repeatedly shown over and over again that glucose and glutamine are the prime drivers of the proliferation of tumor cells.
You know, and Tom, this isn't something new. Otto Warburg went back. I mean, I think new in the sense that you and now others have, you know, proven that this gentleman, Otto Warburg, you know, the early 1900s, this was his theory.
Warburg's major contribution was that respiration was damaged in tumor cells, which a lot of people still can't comprehend. But even those in the metabolism field have difficulty understanding what Warburg actually showed and what he did. But Warburg never discussed the issue of amino acid metabolism or glutamine. He discussed primarily in the terms of lactic acid production from carbohydrates, which is the waste product of carbohydrate or sugar fermentation. He didn't talk much about the amino acid fermentation. We brought that on. We're the ones that are doing that, along with some other people. Now, the issue, of course, is that glutamine is a prime fuel for tumor cells as well as glucose. So the question then becomes, how do you stop glutamine? And people think glutamine is being respired, which means it's being broken down according to normal methods. But that can't be because these cells are fermenting. They have damaged respiration, so they're not going to be able to get energy from glutamine using respiration. So glutamine has to be giving us energy through another mechanism, which is an amino acid fermentation. And that still goes back to Warburg's theory that the respiration of the cell is damaged. So therefore, the way this cell has to survive is through fermentation. And because glucose is so abundant, a lot of tumor cells will be burning glucose as an energy source and fermenting glucose. Yeah. All right. So this is one form. However, there are some tumor cells where you can take away all the glucose and they still survive. So the question is, what are they using to survive? And they are invariably using glutamine, the amino acid. All right? Glutamine is the most abundant amino acid in our body. It's the most abundant amino acid in the bloodstream and in our tissues. The muscle is loaded with glutamine. So this whole concept of cachexia, where the cancer patient starts to look like they're starving even though they're eating, the wasting away of the muscles, is the form of the tumor using glutamine from the muscles to survive. And they're taking the proteins out of the muscle and they're converting them into both glucose and glutamine, and this cancer cell is surviving. Now, you have to ask yourselves, of all of the different therapies that we're using to treat cancer patients, what are the therapies that are targeting glucose and glutamine simultaneously? And the answer is none. There are no therapies that are being used anywhere in the world to treat cancer by targeting the two prime fuels that they're using to ferment. Does it make sense that we're not going to manage this disease if we allow these cells to have access to those two fermentable fuels? And most of the treatments that we use to treat cancer free up more glucose and glutamine in the microenvironment. It is unbelievable that the field cannot comprehend this simple message. They continue to persist. That's why I call it a tragedy. It's a tragedy of monumental proportions that we know what the cells are using to survive and very, very few of the treatments. Some of the targeted therapies shut down the insulin-like growth factor receptor signaling pathway, which is essentially the glucose pathway, which is what Warburg said a long time ago. So those so-called precision medicines are targeting some aspects of what Warburg had proposed. But the cells, they say, oh, they're tough and they can escape that. Yeah, they burn glutamine. If you're not targeting glutamine, they're going to be burning that. And they're going to look like they're escaping. But they're not escaping. These cells are damaged. They're only looking for the fermentable fuels in the environment to stay alive. And as long as they're there, they have a real chance to continue to grow. It's not a complicated problem.
I want to get into some of these things that, you know, you're studying, that we as a group of practitioners around the country are doing, that I believe more doctors and people should be aware of. But, you know, let's go back. I mean, your study's genetics, right? For someone like you with a background, years of studying, you're saying, wait a minute, you know, this isn't the answer. Tom, billions of dollars are being spent. I watch television right now. And if I were the public, if I were the person sitting out there, I would say, surely they're going to cure my cancer because they're going to find that gene and they're going to be able to do something about with a drug that it's going to affect my gene because I have cancer because of the gene. What, you know, what do you say about that? I mean, you're a geneticist here.
It's misinformation. It's based on the gene theory of cancer. And if the gene theory of cancer is not correct, it's not the right theory underlying the disease. How is that information? How are those strategies ever going to work if the disease is not a genetic disease? So the people say, well, how do you know it's not a genetic disease? Because the nuclear transfer experiments clearly showed that it cannot be a nuclear driven genetic disease.
You did one of those studies.
No, I didn't do any of those studies.
Okay.
I
misread. Speak to that for a second in simple terms. Simple terms meant by that.
Okay. What I simply did was bundle and gather those studies up from across several decades, just put them all together in one report, in one group, because they had always existed in the literature, but each one of those studies was considered an anomaly. And none of those studies were designed to test the gene theory of cancer. They were done in a very unbiased way, which is makes them even more powerful. They were not
explain what they did to show this can't be genetic, because it is very simple. The public can understand it.
They were testing whether or not the nucleus of a tumor cell could direct development, not testing whether cancer was a genetic disease or not. So they were very unbiased experiments. So you take the nucleus out of a tumor cell and you put it into a new cytoplasm that can
where the DNA is. The nucleus is where the DNA is.
They take a cancer nucleus, the nucleus of a cancer cell, and put it into a cytoplasm of a normal cell to see whether or not the cancer nucleus can develop an organism or what would happen if this were done?
And stop right there. If it were genetic, if you took the DNA in the nucleus and put it in this cell, that cell then therefore would and should develop cancer, correct?
Yes, according to the theory, because the theory says that cancer, the neoplasia is due to defects in oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes. Therefore, the disease is a genetic disease. It comes from the oncogenes. Dysregulated, which drive the dysregulated cell growth, and the tumor cell also has defects in tumor suppressor genes that are supposed to suppress proliferation. So the combination of these defects together is what ultimately drives the disease. But the nuclear transfer experiments are a direct test of that theory.
What happened? Did it develop a cancer cell?
No, in none of those cases did it do that. They did it in vivo and in vitro, and they looked at the important issue here is that the studies were done by the best scientists in the world in those particular areas of expertise, and they were repeated over and over. The conclusion from each one of these experiments is basically the same: the nucleus of the tumor cell is not responsible for driving the disease. And I can tell you, these guys that did these experiments were the best there are. So when people say, oh, those experiments need to be repeated, they were repeated over and over again by the best people in the field.
So Tom, I mean, how are billions still being spent here then? I mean, it's like if the greatest scientists did these, I mean, how are the billions being spent on this genetic therapy?
People refuse to acknowledge this information. They ignore it. It's too devastating to deal with. What are you going to say if an industry, a multi-billion-dollar industry, is the concepts on which driving the industry are flawed? And also, it's the dogma. It's the dogma that cancer must be a genetic disease. It can't be anything other than that, because Nobel Prize winners have proven that it is a genetic disease. They never tested the alternative hypothesis that it might be a metabolic disease, because their results are the data that they found are solid data. The difference is how you interpret those data in light of the other observations that are associated with this. Right. So when you begin to put all this together it becomes very clear that cancer cannot be a genetic disease. Therefore, any of the therapies that are being used based on that theory are not going to give you the kind of results that you would expect. What are the, I mean, think about it. How many, I mean, every year the number of dead people in cancer goes up. The new cases are going up. If all of this stuff is going to work and it's going to be right, you'd expect a dramatic drop in the number of people dying from cancer. You don't?
Absolutely.
All right, so why is that? Because the theory used to treat the disease is flawed. It's a fundamentally flawed theory.
No doubt.
So the question is, who's going to come to understand this? How long is it going to take the people to come to understand this?
I think that's where my passion lies in this topic. Well, look, there's billions being spent on new immunotherapies. I mean, explain to our listeners and viewers what the immunotherapies are and, you know, what's going on there, because this is where the hope lies right now.
Yeah. Well, the immunotherapies are based on what they call checkpoint inhibitors. The cancer cells have these abnormal gene expressions which inhibit the T cells from killing them. So they're going to make antibodies against these cancer-related proteins on the surface, and also on some of the killer T cells, to allow the T cell to now start to target and kill the cancer cells. The problem is those same antibodies do a job on all kinds of immune cells in your body, and your body starts to attack itself. You could create autoimmune diseases. Yes, there are going to be some people that are going to have spectacular recovery from this. There's no question about it. The problem is that these people are few and far between, and you're going to kill more people than you're going to cure with these kinds of therapies, because they're not based on the fundamental issue that the tumor cells are fermenting. Sure, you can use those other things. Sure, you can irradiate people. Sure, you can poison people with toxic drugs. And yes, there will be people that will survive. But wouldn't it be easier to target the common problem in all the cells of the tumor? Why is nobody, they're not doing that because they're locked into the dogma thinking that this is a genetic disease. Once this dogma is cracked, and believe me, dogma is something that is so hard to convince people. It's like trying to convince a person of one religion that the other religion is the true answer. It's almost impossible to do this.
You're right.
So the argument is that, well, we're going to have to wait for the people who think cancer is a genetic disease to die off, and then the new young people who come in to the field will recognize what we're saying, and then we'll change the paradigm. The problem is, why do we need to sacrifice the lives of millions of people because a few people can't understand the concepts? This is the tragedy that I'm speaking about. I don't think it's necessary to sacrifice the lives of millions of cancer patients because a few people locked into a dogma can't understand the real nature of the disease. This is the tragedy in my line. So the question is, you need to demonstrate that metabolic therapy can manage the disease better than can chemotherapy or radiation therapy. Now, of course, people would love to have the hybrid system, where we combine chemotherapy with metabolic therapy or radiation therapy with metabolic therapy. I don't have time to waste on all that. Okay, I know, I'm not going to sit around for 45 years before we finally shift. It's like the steam. It's like going from sails to steam to eventually to steam, and now nuclear power. I mean, the issue here, I'm not ready to waste my life saying, oh, yeah, let's wait around for another 15, 20 years. You know, the issue here is that if you target glucose and glutamine, the probability of success will be infinitely greater than the stuff that we're doing right now. So the question is, who wants to be the first group to go out and say, let's target glucose and glutamine? Now, I don't want to make it sound like it's that simple. However, because if you take away glutamine, you could certainly damage your immune system. So you have to know, it's not so much whether targeting glutamine will work. Yes, it will work. It'll work remarkably well. In fact, you've got to be careful that it doesn't work so well that it causes tumor lysis syndrome and kills the patient because it was so therapeutically successful. So you just simply have to strategize with dosage, timing, and scheduling to how you're going to target glutamine without harming the immune system, because the immune system uses glutamine. So we're working on that now. That's what we're doing.
Yeah, let, let, let's pull the conversation into two areas that, you know, practitioners are doing, and it's, it, you know, at the heart of a lot of your science and studies. I just, someone just sent me over the other day this article from Science Daily. Science Daily, fasting kills cancer cells of the most common type of childhood leukemia, studies show. You can't see it there, but anyways, I read the headline to you. But so fasting kills cancer cells. This is a new study, Tom. I mean, hey, this was just out December 12th, 2016. You know, I mean, your studies are showing this. So fasting is one of these things. Ketosis that changes your cells from using glucose, forcing it to use fat as an energy.
Wait, can't use fat. Can't use fat. Uses the problem is the tumor cells, if you to burn fat for energy, you have to have good mitochondria. Okay? The cancer That's cell right. has bad mitochondria, so how is it going to use fat for energy? And besides, the That's cancer right. cells are living in, they're living in hypoxic environments. You need a good oxygen respiring system to burn fat for energy. So cancer cells are not going to burn. They're not going to get ATP from the fat, a large amount of it. Some may get a little bit, you know, it depends on what stage the mitochondria are at in their degenerative state. So they, again, fat can't be fermented. Remember, ketones cannot be fermented. Fat can't be fermented. Therefore, ketones and fat cannot be used successfully to keep cancer cells alive. So they have to.
No. Therefore, it's, this is something like fasting or ketosis.
Listen, fasting will lower blood sugar and fat. Force an alternative fuel. Okay, but it doesn't stop glutamine. So it will kill those cells, those cancer cells that are heavily dependent on carbohydrates for their survival. But if you have a tumor cell, like we know this, we did these experiments ourselves. We have metastatic cancer. Metastatic cancer is part of the immune system. They're macrophages that have had destabilized energy metabolism. Those cells survive on glutamine. Those cells, you can fast the hell out of somebody with metastatic cancer, and you're not going to cure his cancer. So you can.
So what do you can? How do you use control cases, Tom?
Oh, that's the challenge. There are drugs that's the challenge, and we're working on that right now. There are drugs, but these drugs can also be very toxic. So it's not what works. It's you know what works, but how do you allow that to work without creating toxicity? So the strategy for managing cancer. Is we can, how do you kill the cell with the minimal amount of toxicity to the body? And that's involved scheduling, timing, and dosages of drugs and diets and procedures that all work together in a beautiful harmony to target and kill tumor cells in a gradual way. Not in this altogether poisonous way, but in a you're gonna degrade the tumor gradually over time while maintaining the health and vitality of the cells in the body.
So we know that we can utilize fasting and ketosis to force the cells into the, you know, fat thing, and cancer cells can't make that transition. But many of the cancer cells can make the transition. Okay, fat, but I'm going to go and utilize this glutamine. I'm going to break the body's muscle down, and I'm going to take this glutamine. And I'm going to survive from it. So what's on the forefront there? We have the on
there
one
are,
side
yes.
to control the What are we doing to control the glutamine? We can control the glucose, but not the glutamine. What are we doing there?
Yeah, well, that's the challenge. That's what a lot of companies are interested in. And they're trying to target specific pathways and on glutamine, on the glutaminolysis side of the coin. But the problem with that is there are many receptors for glutamine. There are many pathways by which glutamine can get into the cell. So the most likely, in my view, at this point in time, would just be using something that binds up or prevents the cell from taking in glutamine. That's basically, you know, blocking glutaminolysis. As I said, this can be toxic as well. In the past, people have used some of these drugs. The problem is they were using them in the wrong concentrations, the wrong scheduling, and they weren't targeting glucose. So if you shut off all the glutamine, and you haven't targeted glucose, the cells simply gobble up the glucose and they survive. So this misconception about tumor cells being very hardy and tough and adaptable. They always like to use the term adaptable. They're adaptable because you never shut off their fermentation. So
that's it.
They're not adaptable. How can you call a cell that has all these broken chromosomes so tough and adaptable? I don't know of any genetically or genetic organism that can survive and be so adaptable when its genome is shot to hell. You know, it's as mutations and broken chromosomes. But what you have is an environment full of fermentable fuels. So as long as those fermentable fuels are in the environment, this cell doesn't need much. It can fall back on the ancient pathways that existed in all cells on the planet before oxygen came on the planet. So these cells are simply falling back on their ancient pathways to ferment in an oxygen-depleted environment. So what are they using? They're using glucose and glutamine. Why glucose and glutamine? Because they're the most abundant fuels in the microenvironment. Can a cancer cell ferment other amino acids? Yes, it can. Well, how do we target those? We don't have to worry about those because they don't exist in the microenvironment in very large amounts. If you're going to fuel a cell that's dysregulated, you have to have plenty of fuel in the environment to give to that. Otherwise, it's going to choke and die. So yes, it can ferment aspartate and asparagine and these other amino acids. The problem is there's so little of that. They'll go through that in a day. And then what? Then there's nothing left. So they're going to die. They're going to die because they can't ferment. Now, there are some cells that have this unique capacity to eat other cells. Oh, this is this is wonderful. So I'm taking away all their fermentable fuels, and these cells will turn around and gobble down another cell and then strip off the glutamine and glucose from the other cell and ferment that inside its own. Some of these cells can do this. So you just have to know about that. And there are drugs that will completely shut down that process. The issue is we have a way to shut down every way that cell can try to squirm out of the restriction of the fermentable fuels. It's just that very few, we're the only ones doing that. There's nobody else out there that's doing this because they think cancer is a genetic disease. So, I mean, you know, go figure. So, you know, if you do this, you'll be, in my view, we will be successful. We will manage this disease without toxicity. Once this information becomes known, accepted, and tried in the clinical trials and things like this. So it's
right now, we don't have the glutamine thing, you know, completely controlled, but just what we have in control, controlling the glucose with fasting and ketosis has already been a massive success.
Yes.
Step further to these types of cancers that have the ability, like these metastatics, to grab onto the glutamine.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we're close if we can get, you know, if you can get more funding. I mean, I don't know how you came up with the funding you do.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, Travis Christofferson's foundation has been very generous. George Hughes Foundation has been generous, so we have private foundation funds that support. They're not enough, no, but they keep the program going. The idea is once, and we've also developed. You have to realize also, it's very important to recognize that we've developed the best preclinical models of glioblastoma and systemic metastatic cancer that exists. So the research that we're doing is based on model systems that replicate all of the conditions that we see in the human. So, and the issue here is most of the investigators in cancer don't have these models. They're using models that don't represent the real world, taking human cells and growing them in an immune-compromised mouse. I mean, this is nonsense. I mean, you can get some information from this, but it's not going to, they say, oh, people cure cancer in mice all the time. No, they don't. Believe me, I've never cured cancer in the mice that I have. So if they're using bogus models, you're going to cure it. You know, I mean, it's just not, a lot of these models don't represent what really happens. Try to stop cancer that's spread into your kidney and your liver and your lymph nodes and your lung and your brain. Try to stop those kinds of cancers and see how successful you are. You're not going to be very successful, any more so than you have in the clinic with the human. Once you have human cancer spreading into your bone marrow, into your brain, into your liver and lung, I mean, this is a very serious disease, and you're not going to win the disease by poisoning the patient to death as the result of this. How many cancer patients are dying from the treatments rather than the disease itself? I mean, this is nonsense what we're doing out there to these poor people.
Yeah, even the immunotherapy, I've heard you say, basically they're killing five for every one that gets a good result, literally decimating them. Sad it is. It's very sad. Well, let's bring it to a positive light. You know, our audience loves fasting. You know, let's talk about some of your studies with fasting. and what you've seen with cancer. And let's talk about some of that.
Well, you know, we started this, you know, we published a paper in 2002 showing that calorie restriction, which is comparable to therapeutic water only therapeutic fasting, because the basal metabolic rate of the mouse is so fast, 8 times faster than that of the human. So if you restrict his food by 40%, the biomarker changes in the mouse's body parallels the biomarker changes in the human body with water only therapeutic fasting. Now, we were able to show that this massively killed these tumor cells and was anti-inflammatory. It was pro-apoptotic, killing the tumor cells. It was anti-angiogenic. It shut down the blood vessels. I mean, we did all this stuff, and it was very clear. And we thought this alone would be the major way to stop cancer. And it's based on Warburg's central theory that the cells, the mitochondria are defective, therefore the cells need glucose. And if you remove glucose, they can't ferment it and they would die. Our eyes became very opened when we developed the metastatic models of cancer. And we were not able to cure or stop systemic metastasis using fasting or even shutting off the glucose. We tried 2-deoxyglucose. We tried a lot of things and we couldn't stop metastatic cancer. And I said, of course you make it better. Of course the animals live longer, just like humans will live longer. But we could not cure metastatic cancer using fasting alone. Now, I'm surprised because humans do so much better than the mice. I'm astonished that, you know, that when humans engage in these activities, I have case after case of people doing therapeutic fasting have had remarkable results in the human clinics. We've never seen this in the mouse. So this gave us the idea there's something else going on here, because I can shut off all the glucose on these mice and I can't stop the metastatic cancer completely. I can shut it down a little bit, but I can't stop it. That's what gave us the idea. It was glutamine. So when we started targeting glutamine, these metastatic cancer cells were blasted out of existence. And I said, oh my God. So these cells will use glucose and glutamine. So the real success, yes, fasting, calorie-restricted, ketogenic diets done the right way can be remarkably therapeutic for patients. But will they ultimately resolve the disease long-term? That's the question. And I don't think so unless you shut down that glutamine pathway, unless you can shut down the glutamine highway. Only then will I think that we could get long-term resolution of this disease. Once we do that, I think we're going to see remarkable long-term resolution for a lot of people that have these diseases. And this is my view. This is what I think.
That's interesting and respect that for sure. One of the things that we look for as practitioners is, you know, in a fasting state or even in an intermittent fasting daily state, is we want to see ketones rise and we want to see glucose drop. If we don't get that glucose to drop, we don't get the therapeutic benefit, even on a non-cancer patient, where we're getting their mitochondria to adapt and become healthier.
Right.
Why is that, Dom? And have you found the same thing?
Well, glucose, you have to realize, Dom D'Agostino is working with a ketone supplement.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you, you can shut down the glucose, but body can live without glucose for the most part, as long as you transition over to ketones. If you don't transition over to ketones, it'll kill you. If you take away your glucose, you're going to drop dead. So you have to, again, everything has to be staged, scheduled, and doses. You bring the patient into a state of therapeutic ketosis. And we know from the work that I've done with Dominic and Angela Poff and others, that if you can raise those ketones high, the tumor cells choke on them. They can't use them for energy. So the key thing is the body will use ketones for energy as long as you can keep the blood sugar low. The lower you can get the sugar and the higher you can get the ketones, the more metabolic stress you'll put on the tumor cells.
I think that's what we see. In other words, you almost don't get the full benefit of the ketones without the glucose dropping. So we want to see this trend of glucose dropping.
Yeah.
They feel the benefits of the ketones. If the glucose stays up, it seems to not have the same effect.
Well, because if glucose stays up, insulin is on, the hormone insulin stays on, and as long as insulin, glucagon, which mobilizes fats, if insulin stays high, you're going to pee out the ketones. That's why you need to measure blood glucose and ketones. So you need to. People say, oh, look at I'm in therapy. I do an Atkins diet. Look at this. I pee in ketones. Yeah, sure you are. But how much you're in the blood? You're peeing those ketones out of your body. You're not keeping them in. So if you lower the blood sugar, the ketones will stay in your body because you're going to need them for energy for your brain. All right. As long as glucose is high, you're not going to be adapting to ketones as readily as you could if glucose were low. So that's the key. If you can get the glucose low, but then you have to use certain kinds of ketones. Well, not all ketogenic diets are the same. So some are much, much better than the others. We patented actually a formulation that we were shocked to find that works so much better than some of these other. So all ketogenic diets are not the same. So it's the ratios of the types of fats that you have in there, the fats with saturated fats, you know, monounsaturated, these kinds of fats, certain kinds, certain ratios, they seem to be much better. And the ketogenic diet is totally different, not totally, but very strongly different from Atkins diets. Atkins diets are just eat as much fat and protein as you can, no carbohydrate. Well, some of those proteins are not good. They'll drive cancer up. And some of the fats in meat can be pro-inflammatory, like arachidonic acid, 24. That's a pro-inflammatory fatty acid that's loaded in meats. You don't want that. That's not part of what you need. Now, will you throw out ketones? Sure, you'll throw out ketones. So people who say that, you know, Atkins diets don't work, they're right. Atkins diets don't work to manage cancer. But ketogenic diets will work so much better, and you have to restrict them. If you have high fat, people eating high fat diets can provoke metastasis. Listen, we've seen it. It's unbelievable. You eat a high fat, high carbohydrate diet, there's nothing that can make those tumor cells grow any faster than that. So these guys going out there saying, oh, you got to lower glucose. You got to elevate ketones. You got to do a lot of things. It's not simple, but it's not super complicated either.
Well, Tom, you throw out a word restriction, and that's something that we clinically, as a group of doctors, well, we all can eat less. That only works short term. Eat less often. And that's where the combination of utilizing fast, even intermittent fasting daily, with ketotic states, there's magic there.
Yeah.
Because the restriction we can get from eating less often actually brings us into where the body doesn't think it's starving. Yeah. And then we get that, what you just said, the restriction allows the body to actually utilize the ketones or the glucose.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I mean, and the other thing we have to be also very cognizant and aware of is fasting and ketogenic diets, and these are weight loss conditions. And they're therapeutic weight loss as opposed to pathological weight loss. And in the cancer community, the oncology community, people always fear that, oh, you know, cancer patients are losing weight, and therefore you can't pile on a therapy that's going to cause them to lose more weight when they're also losing weight. So again, you have to know that certain kind therapeutic weight loss is very, very different than pathological weight loss.
And Tom, let me tell you something. Well, when we do, like my son is a great example, Meredith, right? He started intermittent fasting because the bodybuilders are doing this now where they're eating in a 4 to 6 hour window.
Yeah.
So they're fasting 18 to 20 hours and he's gaining muscle.
Yeah.
And he's saying, why? Because he's in an anabolic growth hormone rises. So it's actually not what these regular doctors are saying here, because when you're fasting like this, a form of restriction, but yet able to hold your muscle. Why? Because it doesn't allow gluconeogenesis because of the growth hormone rise.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, well, that's an important, I mean, I think, you know, you have to, again, the management of the disease will involve all of these situations. There'll be a fasting component. There's a ketogenic diet component. There's a ketone supplementation component. There's a hyperbaric oxygen component. There are drugs that are going to lower and target glucose even more once the body is in ketosis. And there'll be drugs that target glutamine. And also stress management is also part of the package. You know, we're working on a big paper right now with several of my collaborators called Press Pulse, a metabolic therapy for cancer. And it's a combination of diets and drugs and procedures that all work synergistically together to achieve the management of the disease while enhancing the health and vitality of the body. And this is what I think is going to be ultimately, in the long run, once people come to realize that this is a metabolic disease, will be the way that cancer will be managed. It's going to be a strategy, but you have to have physicians that understand, you have to have nurses that understand, dietitians and nutritionists that understand, And right now, very few people understand. So food will be used as medicine.
We had a short conversation that day in the mastermind group in Florida. You know, I do something, and I've written articles about diet variation, but, you know, I'm a firm believer. Bad cells don't adapt. You know, you made the point earlier. Cancer cells adapt. What are you kidding me? These are weakened cells. The whole point of fasting and doing some of these therapies is bad cells don't adapt. You know, moving people, we've learned, moving people in and out of ketosis, in and out of different fasts, and unhealthier people can do shorter fasts, but each fast, they seem to get more efficient through the fact that, you know, what's happening is bad cells are dying, autophagy, good cells are getting stronger. So moving people in and out of these different states, it's all about adaptation. What's your thought?
Yes. No, I think that's perfect. I wrote about that. If you constantly change the metabolic environment, only cells that have a good genome will be able to adjust and adapt to these changes. A cell with a bad genome is going to be eliminated. Yeah. So absolutely moving people in and out of these conditions will absolutely be essential for the management of the disease. And that's part of our press pulse strategy. So you have certain parts of the therapies that are pressing constantly on the tumor cells. And then you have pulses that come in and out at the same time. So you're pressing and you're pulsing on an in and out strategy. When do you use hyperbaric oxygen? When do you use a drug that will target glutamine? When do you use the glycolysis inhibitor together with the ketones and the diet? How do you manage the stress of the patient? How do you integrate exercise into this process? How do you do all this to have a synergy, a symphony of synergies is basically what you're trying to do. So and this can be done once we're working on those exact that exact scenario right now in our strategy. We have to demonstrate that this can work.
Yeah, I keep me involved. Because this is my theory. Meredith will tell you I get overwhelmed coming out of my chair right now because. You know, you're the scientist, I'm the clinical guy. And I can tell you that when you move in and out of these states, you create an adaptation issue. All we have to do is look at ancient cultures and know that they were forced into being in ketosis and not. And these different things happening at different times, but it forced adaptation. Cells don't adapt. I'm telling you, there's magic in the variation. You know, you saw me turn Joe Mercola's mind on that, and he ended up adding his book, The Feast Famine Cycle.
Yeah,
you know, it's like more of what you're saying. You know, the press pulse.
Yeah.
Philosophy, and I'm with you on it.
Yeah, well, I think it'll be eventually. And I always keep the same. Eventually, it'll eventually be the way we're going to manage the disease. It will be because it's based on sound scientific fact. I mean, we're going after the heart. They're going after the weakest point of these cells, and we're doing it while we're enhancing the health and vitality of the body. It will be the way to go. It's just that we have to train physicians to do this. None of this is being trained in the medical schools. This is not, food is not viewed as medicine. These kinds of therapeutic strategies are not viewed at all. So the very individuals whose job it should be to implement these are not being trained to do it. They're just simply not being trained. And this is because people think cancer is a genetic disease. And you're going to have to go after the personalized medicine. You can change personalized. Metabolic therapy can be personalized. Metabolic therapy is precision medicine. It's just that it's not related. The gene mutations are largely irrelevant. They're not. They're effects. They're not causes for this. Mm-hmm. So once these concepts become more widely, my view is let's show the evidence. Let's show in preclinical models that the strategy that we're talking about actually works. And if you can show it works in preclinical models and dogs, let's be honest, the dogs are suffering the same way humans are. We're using dogs as therapy. My friends are using dogs. Dogs are responding remarkably well to these therapies. So if dogs and mice with metastatic cancer can respond, humans can respond. So it's only, and who's going to force this? Who's going to force the change? It's certainly not going to come from the top medical schools. It's got to come from the grassroots. People want to live. People want to live, and they don't want to be poisoned. If there is a way that they can live without being poisoned, they're going to want to do it. They're the consumers. Remember, the patient is the consumer. If the consumer no longer wants the product you're offering, the change will have to occur. It's just that simple. And how do you
no doubt that's
you educate people. Basically, you demonstrate
educating. Listen, that's why we need you at our conference. From there, Meredith, we got 200, 300 probably doctors at that event that need, you know, we're training doctors around the country in what I call, you know, a multi-therapeutic approach. And all of the things we're talking about is a part of that. Like you said, it's not one thing, you know, but we're utilizing these things. And it's remarkable to me how few doctors are. They even understand this adaptation principle that you and I are discussing right now. I mean, amazing things that we are doing, and yet so few know about it. We need you at the conference, Doc. And Meredith, I know you have some questions, so I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, thanks so much. This episode has been an incredible wealth of knowledge, and I do have a number of questions, but I know we're at the top of the hour. But the discussion on glutamine is so fascinating to me, and I think, well, gosh, I've taken glutamine as a supplement a lot to support my gut health. And how does that fit in with this?
No, glutamine is very important for gut health. I mean, and glutamine is important for our overall health because our immune cells use glutamine. Glutamine is a major fuel for our lymphocytes, macrophages, natural killer cells, for dendritic cells. Our immune system, when people are burned, large doses of glutamine are given because we open our body to infection from bacteria. And our immune system needs to kill the bacteria. And glutamine is a powerful fuel for our immune system to kill bacteria. So the issue, of course, is that cancer cells are also using the glutamine. So how do you balance this? How do you walk this fine line between you needing glutamine for the immune system and knowing the cancer cells need the same fuel to keep them going? This is our challenge right now. This is what we are doing right now. We are defining what that fine line is, and we are coming across the fine line to strike hard at the tumor cells and then back off and rebuild the immune system. Strike and rebuild. Strike and rebuild. And you do this under a physiological program that keeps the body healthy or you minimize toxicity to the greatest. No one is doing this. We're the only ones that are doing this right now.
But if someone doesn't have cancer, then it would probably be a fairly safe supplement to rotate into the regime.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think there's any problem with it at all. It's good for people. You know, it's an important supplement if you know how to use it the right way.
Right. And what are your thoughts on exogenous ketones? You mentioned them briefly, but therapeutically, are you using them? Are you not using them? Why?
We're working on them. There's a lot of different products on the market for this. You have to be careful. Some of them have too much glucose in the product, my view is you know, use your glucose ketone meter and see what it does to your GKI, your glucose ketone index. And if it makes your glucose ketone index really low, which is what you want, then that's good. If it doesn't, from my experience, the ketones are horrible tasting. I mean, the really good ones that work, we got to make them taste there. As Dominic says, they taste like jet fuel. I mean, it's not this stuff you have to choke down, you know. And to make a ketone supplement that tastes sweet and nice, you got to be careful. I mean, I don't know what it's going to do. So I'm not willing to commit myself to any kind of a product or any kind of a. All I know is that the body makes ketones naturally, but that only comes when you do therapeutic fasting. So that's the whole. But getting back to the really health benefits of therapeutic fasting is we make natural, you know, D-beta hydroxybutyrate, which is the ultimate enhancer of mitochondrial function. Can you take a supplement that will do the same thing? Yeah, people are trying to do this because everybody wants things in life to be easy. They don't want to fast. They just want to drink some sort of a slurry and get the same benefit. But sometimes it doesn't work as well. You know, if you do fasting with ketone supplements, oh boy, I mean, if you get the right ketone supplement with a fast, I mean, that could be lights out for a lot of tumor cells, I can tell you that. So, but again, this all has to be worked out and evaluated, and that needs to be, and the food industry is very interested in this. That's where the food industry is moving into the space that the pharmaceutical industry should be in. Yeah. But we'll see what happens with that as things progress.
No, I appreciate that. But, you know, here it is, Tom, you know, well, fasting kills cancer cells, right?
Who did that study?
December 12th, 2016.
Who was that? Longo's group?
Utah Southwest Medical Center. Summary, intermittent fasting inhibits the development and progression of most common types of childhood leukemia, researchers have found. Who did it? Let's see.
Well, it should. I mean, it's if they're glucose dependent, they're going to die, you know.
Yeah, I'll send it to you.
Childhood leukemia. Well, I mean, we know this. We've done so many studies in this already. I mean, we've published a lot on that. So
yeah, no,
not surprising to me. It would be surprising if it didn't work.
I'll send it to Meredith. I'll send it to you, and you can make sure Tom gets it. Okay.
Yeah.
Sounds great. Wow.
Yeah, no, I thought it was great because it proves something that you've already proven.
We've seen that a long time ago. I mean, this is, and it works. I'd say that it works better in humans than it does in the mice. I can tell you that much.
Yeah. No, Tom, listen, we so appreciate your work. Everyone needs cancer as a metabolic disease. You know, it's doctors, if you're watching this, if you don't have this, I mean, you know, shame on you. This should be on your shelf right here. I tell you what, I refer to it. It's always in reach because, I mean, I tore this thing apart. You can see every little thing. I mean, I'm constantly grabbing it even to reference a study. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much. And in closing, Professor Seyfried, I just like to ask if you have any words for someone who's watching the show today and has cancer, what would you say to them?
Well, I'd say to them that there's hope for the future. It's the real kind of hope, not the false hope that some of these other therapies are delivering. Unless the cancer moonshot, all the money that President Obama just signed in on the basis of Vice President Joe Biden effort, unless that money is going to metabolic understanding cancer as a metabolic disease, I would say it's going to be largely wasted. So, wow. just as it's been for decades, I would say that the future of cancer management will come to be when they realize it's a metabolic disease. And this will be, in my view, the way we're going to manage this disease. It's just when people are going to come to understand this and how fast will all these smart guys for the first time do something that is actually smart. It's...
Amen.
You know that.
Billions.
It's just going to take time.
Billions being spent on a false dogma. That's a shame.
Yeah, that's basically what it comes down to, you know. So until the dogma is changed, we're pretty much going to have this same old. So, and only the statistics will show you that. Just look at as I said in the book. If you want to know how the war on cancer is going, read the obituary pages in your local newspaper, and then you'll know.
Yeah. Bingo. Yeah. We better change our philosophy, that's for sure. Thanks, Doc.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone. A sobering ending, but there is hope. With all of these different strategies you guys employ, along with the multi-therapeutic approach, that there are answers and solutions. So thanks so much, Professor Seyfried. Thank you, Dr. Pompa. Thanks for tuning in, guys, and we'll see you next week.
Okay. Thank you. Bye now.
Bye.